Okay, we're just coming up on 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and get us started. So I'm going to mute all, as always. Everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. If you do so to ask a question or a comment, please remute yourself afterwards so that we can keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, copy of the deck in PDF format, the audio track, and the contents of the chat window will go up on the website, courtesy of Alan. If anybody had been looking for the deck from last week's presentation by Sira at our main meeting, I just managed to get the deck today from the speaker. She's been sick and so has been incommunicado. So those slides are available on our website under the past meetings section. So feel free to fill your boots on that one. And I don't think there's any other announcements that I need to be making. So I think with that, we've got quite a bit on the agenda. I'll kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Okay, well, we might as well get right in with our follow-up item. We were talking about Facebook last week, or 2 weeks ago, and Elizabeth sent in this note that she has a personal account on Facebook because she wanted to use Marketplace, but recently she got blocked from Marketplace. And although you can moan and complain, there's probably no human at the other end, so nothing much happens. But a few days ago, after being blocked, suddenly the account was unblocked. So she says she doesn't troll, and she only has three friends, and they're all relatives. And no idea what's going on, and I like this. Facebook is a swamp. So there you go. My thoughts exactly. I'm not a huge Facebook spam. Okay,
Okay, and
Chris has got a.
you're gonna give me control on slides.
I'll do that, yeah, if I can find the controls. No, seriously, I've lost the controls here. Oh, here we are. Maybe. No.
Okay, I'll go ahead and start talking while you're finding that. So at last week's meeting, we did a presentation on Sira services, and I think there's a little bit of confusion about exactly what one of the services called Canadian Shield actually does provide for you. And so I just wanted to give a little bit of extra information on that. And so it is a free DNS security service, and this is how they describe it, to protect Canadians from online threats. And this is quote off of the website at Sira. So Canadian Shield double checks to see if websites are malicious, and if we know they are, we'll stop you from visiting them. Service is completely free, no advertising, no tracking, no reselling of your data, which is a nice thing. So let's step back just a little bit and say how normal DNS works. So DNS is the phone book for the internet. So say you want to browse to opcug.ca. So your computer doesn't know how to get to opcug.ca. It knows how to get to an IP address. Now opcug happens to be at this current point in time anyways at 134.195.196.134. But how does your computer figure out that that's what it is? And that's where the domain name service comes into play. So your computer asks a DNS server, give me the IP address for opcug.ca. The DNS server says, oh, okay, this is what the IP address is. And then your computer connects to that particular IP address. So how does Canadian Shield work instead? So what if OPCUG is a malicious site, and yeah, it probably should have chosen somebody else's site to imply that it might be malicious. But at any rate, we go on.
Facebook.com.
Sorry?
Facebook.com.
Facebook.com. Yeah, that's right. So Canadian Shield to the rescue for protecting you. So your computer asks the DNS server, in this case you're connected to the Canadian Shield DNS service, give me the IP address for opcug.ca. If the Canadian Shield knows that that's malicious, then what it can do is, rather than just returning you the IP address of the site, it can return you another IP address that'll be a warning page, or it could be a non-existent site or something like that. So anything to prevent you from actually going to opcug.ca because they know it to be malicious. If Canadian Shield thinks it's not malicious, then it acts just like a regular DNS service, and it gives you the IP address and your computer goes to that. So some of the details, so some other quotes on this, we bring in dozens. So like this is where they get their information about whether something is malicious or not. They say we bring in dozens of threat feeds and powerful AI from Akamai, which is a distributed content provider worldwide, analyze billions of DNS queries globally every single day, detects over 100,000 new threats daily to help keep you safe online. Now, they're not very prescriptive about it. I found a little bit of other information at the Canadian Center for Cybersecurity about Canadian Shield, and they have a very good detailed breakdown on how Canadian Shield actually works and DNS security services in general, very good description of it, and they talk a little bit more about where the actual data is coming from. So Canadian Shield, you actually have three options. There's private, which is basically just offering DNS resolution without any protection at all. The standard protected adds malware, phishing, botnet, and scam protection to the DNS service. And then you can choose a third level, which is called family, and it adds blocking of pornographic content if you want to do that. Detailed instructions on how to set up Canadian Shield are in the and I pasted this into the chat. So detailed instructions on how to set it up, including for any operating system, gaming consoles, browser extensions, all kinds of things that you can set up. So fill your boots with that. It's actually a very good service. There are some other free options that are available. So Quad9, Norton DNS, and OpenDNS Home are three options that are available free of charge. Quad9 is an interesting one. It was actually started by IBM Security, and it is now a not-for-profit consortium of over a dozen firms, and they have over 800 terabytes of threat intelligence data. OpenDNS Home and actually the Family Shield is one that's kind of interesting. It actually allows you to select from various categories that you want to be blocked, not just the catch-all of malicious and then adding on pornographic if you want, but if you wanted to block soap opera sites or, you know, whatever, messaging sites or things like that, there's over 50 categories that you can decide you can block. And so that's it for that.
Okay, there's a question here, Chris, in the chat. If I go to Bitdefender's dashboard, it tells me when sites were blocked, but I don't know how to determine. Can I use Canadian Shield as well as Bitdefender with no conflict?
Yeah, you can. There's no problem. It's two different layers that it's being done at. With Bitdefender, it is probably doing it as a browser extension, probably. So it probably adds in a browser extension, and it's blocking based, again, on known bad sites. And so that's, you know, that's fine. There's no problem with that. And you could add Canadian Shield as an additional layer of blocking. So potentially if Bitdefender doesn't classify something as being malicious and Canadian Shield does, it'll still be blocked and vice versa. So if Canadian Shield thinks something is not malicious, but Bitdefender thinks it is malicious, it'll still end up getting blocked.
Okay. All right. Next up was this question that came up about missing endnotes, and there's a lot of discussion, which we'll get to in a minute. But some of the questions were, what are endnotes? Some people didn't actually know what endnotes were. I imagine everybody knows what footnotes are. Basically, in Word, if you have some kind of statement and then you want to have a reference, you can add a footnote, so it will be numbered here. And then footnotes basically end up at the bottom of the page where they were referenced. So that's hence footnotes, and that's where you get the concept of headers and footers. So the footnotes go in the footer of the page. And endnotes are very similar. They're a reference-type system. But generally, with endnotes, I mean, one of the classic examples would be in scientific papers where somebody's introducing a topic here, talking about prior Canadian research, and then wants to give a reference to an earlier paper on the subject. So in this case, it's being added as an end note, and you notice that the end notes are automatically numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, and the end note actually, as you might imagine, goes to the end of the document. So here, a set of a references section, and the end notes are actually showing up as references to the various papers. So this was the problem for our questioner, that these end notes were in the document. They were sent off by email, and when the document came back, there were no endnotes anymore in the file, which is really strange. I mean, that should not happen. There are a whole raft of suggestions that people had. one was suggesting that you should check how footnotes and endnotes are displayed, and you can do that by going through this navigation sequence right here, and try a different word processing program. Suggestion here was Google Docs. Somebody else thought that maybe the editor was using WordPerfect to open a Word file, and that was a problem. And that's highly unlikely. I'm sure the author knows what the editor's using. And even if they don't, WordPerfect is actually more Word compatible than Word. So I would be really surprised if that was the issue. another different Office package was using Writer in the LibreOffice package. And one suggestion was just to save the endnotes as a separate document, like a final page, I guess, as a separate document. And then there were some references here to things on the web, answers.microsoft.com, thing about disappearing endnotes. Somebody suggested try increasing the height of the footer. I don't think that will help endnotes because they don't appear in the footer, as I say, they're at the end of the document. another person suggested disabling endnotes and converting the references basically to plain text. And you can do that using this set of navigation items. Make sure that endnotes are actually turned on rather than being disabled. So show notes and show all endnotes. And then finally, some other web pages that were kind of relevant about endnotes and endnotes disappearing and endnotes being missing and all kinds of stuff. So lots of things to check and see if can find out why the endnotes had disappeared out of the document. So we remain to hear back if that has been successful. Okay, next up, Chris has got a YouTube tech video.
Yeah, this was kind of a fun one. Dave Plummer, he's a retired Microsoft engineer. He worked on versions of DOS through XP and NT and 2000. So he has a channel that has fascinating information on it. And in this one, he talked about Longhorn. And Longhorn was supposed to be the successor for Windows XP. And Microsoft had some very lofty goals in what they wanted for it. And it looked like they chewed off a little bit too much. And they had to do a complete reset on it. And eventually it went into becoming Windows Vista. But it's really quite a fascinating story. So if you're interested in knowing what happened with Longhorn and why Microsoft, you know, essentially threw out several years worth of work and reset completely before they came out with Windows Vista, take a look at the video, and it's pasted into the chat.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And a second YouTube video. And previously we've had a few videos from Leo Notenboom, the Ask Leo guy, and Marvo points out that he came across another one that he really liked, was Cyber CPU Tech. And in particular, this video, how to make Windows 11 look like Windows 10. So if you're running Windows 11 and you're yearning for the old days, maybe there are some tips in here to tell you how to go back in time. Okay, next up we have a share from Stuart. So Stuart, you will have to unmute your microphone and tell us all about Green Banks.
Hello, world. I found this website some time ago and thought, since nobody gives a shit about green stuff anymore with all the current political situations going on, it was a good time to reintroduce it. This is a website that will, actually, it's a worldwide survey of financial institutions, and it you plug in the which one you're interested in, and it'll tell you exactly how green their banking practices are. Not so much like recycling and stuff like that, but more where they invest your money. So I didn't really look at the worldwide institutions. I kind of focused in on my banks and the other banks in Canada, and found that, as usual, most of the Canadian banks, the major ones, just love oil. We stink. You know, I mean, that's where the money is, right? So we invest there and we get good returns on it, but we're also burning up the planet. So I found, digging a little deeper, basically the credit unions tend to be really environmentally friendly. So if you have any interest in greening the world or not burning it down, you might want to check this out and see where your bank scores. And then think about how you can use that information. Now, you know, given the demographics of our group, most of us are pretty settled in our ways at this point in life. We're not going to just switch our bank because we want to, you know, feel better about things. We're more concerned about where our investments are. But you can sort of think about it a little more clearly. Like, for example, many years ago, I shifted away from major banks and got into a credit union for the better banking fees. And I was quite happy to find out through this website that they're reasonably green. I'm speaking of the Alterna, formerly known as a civil service credit union, but now it's called our Alterna Bank. They're reasonably green. They do okay. But, you know, if you don't live in Ontario, I don't think you can set up an account there any, if you're trying to get into it. And they have other limitations too. As an example, I live in Quebec and I can't pay my driver's license, fee annually from Alterna. I have to use Tangerine to do that. And Tangerine, of course, is owned by the Bank of Nova Scotia, which is pretty horrible on the grand scheme of things, in a green sense of the words. But if I just keep enough money in Tangerine to pay my Quebec driver's license once a year, and do a few other things that I'm not going to talk about in public, then I can use the dirty bank and, you know, maintain my ability to drive to those things that I'm not going to talk about. And I can use the credit union for the bulk of my investments and maintain a reasonably green sort of profile on the planet. I think it's interesting and worthwhile looking at if you're interested in this sort of thing. I'm going to divert from the, that's all I've got to say about this, but I want to add something about an app I mentioned a couple weeks ago, and which was the Yuka app, just to say that we've been using it quite extensively in the last couple weeks, and it's really been quite useful. This was the app that looked at how environmentally friendly your groceries and cosmetics were if you were shopping, which kind of ties into green things. So, you know, it sort of blends into this topic. It was really interesting because we were finding that a lot of the brand name environmentally friendly products that we were looking at scored quite mediocre on the app's ratings, but a lot of the store brand stuff was coming up as excellent. And just like big name banks aren't as green as they say they are, sometimes store brand name products aren't as green as they claim to be and healthy they seem to be. Eldon says alternative bank, alternative savings. Yeah, whatever. I don't know, Eldon. I have an alternative account. And you know what? I can't get a credit card from them because I live in Quebec. I can only get one if I live in Ontario. Anyway, that's not the focus of what I'm talking about. If you want to know what your bank's green rating is, check out, what the heck is this website? I forgot the URL. Anyway, that's all I've got to say. I've sort of rambled off into nowhere.
Thank you very much, Stu. Okay, next up we have a share from Chris.
It wouldn't be a Q&A if we didn't talk about AI. So just a little bit of fun in ChatGPT. So I uploaded a photo. This is a new capability they apparently have. So I uploaded a photo, and then I added a prompt, say, create a picture of me as a 3D action figure toy, as if it's displayed in transparent plastic blistering package, put my name on it, give it a title, give it my email address, and add some accessories to it. And this is what it generated. So you too can go to ChatGPT and create a little action figure of yourself. Just upload a headshot, or it can be a full body shot. It'll pick out the face out of it, and you can make your own action figure.
How do you get it shipped to you?
Yeah, it's just graphic, so you just – well, you don't get the actual action figure. You get a picture of it. No, I asked it to create a picture, that's all. I didn't ask it to generate the action figure.
It's sold out.
We're going to start selling these on opcug.ca.
Yeah, right.
It's 3D printed, right?
If you want to, go for it.
That's a question. Is there any AI for 3D printing?
I do not know.
Bound to be. We'll let somebody look it up and report back.
There you go.
Do you need to go out?
Okay, next up we have, if you have an old computer and you don't know what to do with it, then Phil is going to share his screen and give you his ideas of what you can do with old hardware. You have to unmute yourself also, Bill.
Okay, there we go. All right, now. There we go. Can you hear me?
Yes,
we can.
Can
hear you, but
can you see my screen?
The green button yet for share.
Oh, I'm I haven't, eh? Can you see the second screen?
We don't see your share yet.
Okay, in that case, that's kind of weird. I clicked on share.
Oh, did you hit the share button the second time at the bottom?
Maybe I did.
You have to choose the screen.
And then hit share again.
All right, just a second here. That's my screen not working. Just
we can see your screen with your picture on it, but we can't see the other screen.
Okay, well, Alan has your slides, so how about Alan, okay. You do the share, and Phil can just direct you to forward.
Okay.
Or I can give him slide control, maybe.
Yep, that's true.
Okay, so I can... Okay, so Alan, you're going to control the slides?
I can, or you should have the capability, too. There should be a pop-up on your Zoom.
You have to move your mouse over below where the slides are showing. And you'll have control L in German slides.
Okay. Oh, I see right here. Nope.
Well, only you want to go forward.
I want to go forward.
There you go.
All right, I'm going backwards. There we go. All right, well, thanks for having me. So this propped up on one of the forum conversations. So what do you do with your old computer equipment? And there's lots of issues to think about in terms of metals, toxicity, the environment. There are even, some pretty serious stuff that's inside those computers. That's why you can't put it in a green garbage bag and stick it out into the street so that it ends up in the landfill site. All right, now let's see if I can go to the next screen.
Yes.
Okay, so it just takes time to do it. All right, well, most people, I think, seem to want to just get all the clutter out of their house. And as soon as it's gone, the better off they feel. So there's some options for that. You can always take your stuff to Best Buy. They have a trade-in scheme. They won't tell me exactly how it works. They'll only tell me, bring your stuff in, and we'll take a look at it and see whether or not we're going to give you a store credit. I would imagine they're looking for equipment that is really recent or in some kind of working condition, because they do sometimes give that off to groups who put computer equipment together for needy people. So it can go to an actually good use other than just getting destroyed or recycled. Ottawa has the metal recycling sessions that happen, maybe three times a year. If you go to one of them, you can find out from the people that are there where the next one is, just in case you have a second load. It really boils down to, I think, what you're willing to do to reduce, reuse, and recycle the equipment. Getting it all out of your house is great, but where is it going? That's the question that I'm trying to put forward. To reduce, the only thing you can really do there is not buy a new computer, because as soon as you buy a new one, it puts a new one into the whole stream of things. And that's not going to happen, because everybody's getting excited about the new chips, the new AI, all of the wonderful things that are coming out in the new machines. And I'd certainly like to make that jump up to that level as well. What I'm talking about is a lot of reuse of things. What's left in the rest of the slides are things that I've done or friends of mine have done, with the exception of two things that actually came out of the discussion on the forum. So you can sell off or donate parts still needed, like RAM, data drives, optical drives, graphic cards. I've underlined motherboards with CPU and RAM because a lot of hobbyists want this stuff. They do not want to pay $3,000 for a computer and stick it on their workbench. They want something cheaper so that if they happen to blow it up tomorrow, it hasn't cost them a lot of money. And, it just makes more sense for what they're doing. I've sold motherboards to people, old ones that people have picked up. They send me a message, tell me that they'll pay me my price. Here's my address and my postal code. Tell me what the shipping is going to be. Add that in. I write them back. They send me an email transfer for the money. I package it all up, send it that day, and then send back to them the tracking code so that they can make sure that it's coming to them. Sometimes I'm surprised what people will buy, but a lot of people just, they don't want to spend a lot of money for a lot of their applications, and we'll discuss that as we go through. So you have to think really about what a collector or a hobbyist could do with your stuff, and think about what you may be able to do to reuse it and continue to have that computer serve some purpose. There it goes. Collectors will pay you if your equipment is old, is in working order, and contains vintage software. They may already have vintage software, so that may not be necessary. But when they display that computer in their collection, they want it to be working and showing some purpose that that computer would have had at the time that it was, a popular and, you know, right at the forefront of computing. So the software isn't necessary, but it certainly sweetens the pot. I've only met one of these guys. They all seem to know each other in the Ottawa or Eastern Ontario area. The fellow that I met, he really has already sorted out how much money he's willing to pay for things. And he pretty well lays it right out. I'm willing to pay this much if you're interested. That's great. If you want to wait on it, call me back in a couple of weeks, whatever you like. But they pretty well know what they want and how much they're going to pay. So things like computers, peripherals, printers, software, etc., whatever you have, advertise it wherever you want, the GG Facebook Marketplace, but say serious collectors only. You really don't want somebody writing to you and saying, you know, why are you trying to sell me this piece of crap? You don't want that. You want to address your audience. And that'll work, because most of these guys that are collectors, they have friends that troll the internet. They know what their friend wants, and they will tell him, okay, you should take a look at this ad because I think this is something you're interested in. And that'll help. Now, I've underlined cables because cables are disappearing. There's a lot of people who collect cables in order to harvest the metal out of them. They burn the exterior sheathing off the cables. But if you have one of those old 12-foot...
Okay. You need to go up 38. Come on.
No, not yet. Okay. I guess someone's dog is there. The cables, yeah. They're disappearing because of the people that harvest the metals. And collectors need them. They'll pick up an old computer, an old printer of the same vintage. They need something to connect them. And often the cables are gone. So you know those big 12-foot serial cables, you know, with the big serial ends and the thousands of pins inside them? Those are actually in demand. Now, they're only going to pay so much for it, but if you have cables, you can put them out there and hopefully somebody will get them. Hobbyists may have many creative applications for your stuff. Often they need very low power, and they don't want high cost. Model railroaders use computers to control tracking on various routes of their trains. I have a friend who does this, and I think he uses an old 286 in order to do it, because he can program in a very simple language. And he'll say, okay, train A needs to run on route B, and the computer will automatically set up, change the switching on the tracks so that the train won't do that route. Computers can be used to control switching circuits of any kind. And here, I mean, I don't know how many hundreds of things I could list here. Switching circuits can be used for outdoor or indoor lights, Christmas lights, ponds, irrigation, all sorts of things. So really, there's a lot of stuff that really fits into that category. Something I've done is desktop power supplies can be modified to become a workbench power supply, providing voltages of 12, 5, and 3.3. I think it's really only the 12 and the 5 that are plus or minus. I think 3.3 only comes in plus, but I can't really remember. If you do this, then you've got to be very careful, because the currents would be lower than you might think from a 500-watt or a 300-watt power supply. Power is equal to voltage times current. So if you take 500 watts divided by 12 volts, you are not going to draw 40 amps through one of these things. If you did, you'd melt it. You might set your workbench on fire. You might set your house on fire. So you've got to be very careful what you hook them up to. And adding a 1-amp or a 500 milliamp fuse between this power supply and what you're working with is maybe a smart thing to do if you're not too sure of what you're doing. You twist all the clip ends of a single color together. You solder the ends of each color group, and then you attach each group to a post. The kinds of posts I like are the ones that have the banana plugs in the top, or you can unscrew the post and add a spade connector or a wire or something that's in there. You can set it all up on a piece of wood. You don't have to be fancy and put it in a box of some kind, but you do have to measure the voltages and label them so you remember which one is which. Okay, you can support and display electronic test equipment like oscilloscopes. You remember the oscilloscopes that had those round cathode ray tubes sticking out at the front like a big, huge eye? They don't make those anymore. If you buy an oscilloscope, you're buying a box that has everything in it except the cathode ray tube, and you display that on a computer screen. You get a bigger, better display, and you get a lot of other diagnostics as well. You can also connect your computer up so that it's metering things like currents and resistance and capacitance, but you need the probes for that. Sensors like temperature, humidity, soil saturation. Some of the schools have these sensors, particularly for temperature and humidity. And some of those are hooked up to computers for science experiments and whatnot to try and get computers into the classroom. You can design and test circuits through software to improve vintage radio, ham radio, and audio equipment. A friend of mine is a retired electrical engineer, and he's been working on vintage radios for a lot of his life. The first thing you have to do with a vintage radio is probably replace all the capacitors, because all of the wadding and material that's in those capacitors has probably dissolved. So once that's done, you can actually look at the circuits, and the circuits are available, believe it or not, online, depending on the radio that you find. And you can put that through the software in order to improve the circuitry itself. So unless you want something that is really, pristine in terms of its vintage, if you don't mind changing things, you're all right. Ham radio equipment, audio equipment can all be improved with software like that. And you don't need a heavy-duty power machine. You don't need a $3,000 machine to do this. Amateur astrophotographers use computers to capture and stack images of celestial objects and help guide the telescopes. A telescope today, a go-to scope, is already connected to global positioning. So they're GPS units. But something has to tell the computer or tell the telescope that you want to look at the Whirlpool Galaxy, which is right above your head in the middle of the winter. It's nice if it's above your head because you're shooting through a lot less atmosphere than if something that's on the horizons. So you need a computer in order to make those decisions and tell the GPS system where to look. Let me go here. Okay, change of tact. So we've kind of looked at, the hobbyists. We've looked at collectors. Now, what about yourself? What can you do with it? Well, if you use an old computer, you have to keep the original OS. The cost and compatibility of a new OS license may be completely prohibitive. So you've got to do something to do to preserve that. Make sure that you have a system backup and a file backup on an external drive. You can store a current ISO file somewhere on an external drive, and that will give you a little bit more protection if you have a system problem on an older computer. ISO files are still available. That I was fixing up an older Acer computer with Windows 7. I managed to get, with the help of Tom and his reference to, I think it's IT ethics, I got a 32-bit and a 64-bit version of Windows 7 Home Premium, but I noticed that the 7 Pro wasn't available anymore. But ISO files are still available for some older systems. If you can get one, that's great. Replacing the CMOS battery. That's really important. CMOS batteries are usually 3-volt 2032s. They're very common. I bought 4 about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I paid $18 at Canadian Tire, so that's about, you know, a little less than $5 each. If you buy one, you're going to pay $7 or $8. I need them for a lot of things. There's a lot of things in my house that use these little batteries. How do you know that you have to take it out and replace it? Well, these batteries last in a computer for anywhere between 4 to 10 years. They're kind of like tea bags. Some of them are very strong and some of them aren't. Now, how do you know you got a CMOS problem? You might notice a little erratic performance in your computer. You might notice the date or the year going off. Likely what's going to happen is you're going to turn your computer on one day and it's going to look like it's dead. There'll be nothing on the screen. You'll think the screen has died. You may or may not hear a little whirring from the disk drive if it's a spinner. But you're going to think that your computer is absolutely dead, and it probably isn't. And all you really need to do is change the CMOS battery. The problem with doing that is manufacturers don't tell you where they are, and that's because they don't know where they are. There are so many different parts going into the same model of the same make that there's no way they can predict which parts are going to go on which computer and where it's going to be. So you have to hunt around. There's three places to look. Between the keyboard and the screen, there's a little section right in between that if you push that forward, lift it up and pull it back towards you, it'll come out. You have to do it carefully so you don't break it. CMOS battery might be in there. If it isn't, then reinstall it, flip the machine over, try to take the covers off. Well, you can take the covers off, the hard drive and the memory. Look around and see if you can see anything there. If you can't, you have to take the whole bottom off. That's probably 15 different screws. But when you lift it up, you have to be careful because there's a lot of ribbon cables that go between those parts. If you look around the outside, you'll probably find it close to the edge. All you have to do is flip the old one out, put the new one in, and you're all set. As far as the laptop battery packs are concerned, you can remove them and just run it on a cord. You can rebuild it if you do that kind of thing or get a company to do it. That's probably too expensive. You can replace it. For kicks, I looked at the cost of replacing the battery in my Acer 5542 that I've been working on, and I found one available for $50. I'm not going to buy one because I don't need to, but they are out there. They won't be from the original manufacturers, though. They'll be third party. I would suggest you stay off the internet with the older machine or go with extreme caution because you don't want, I mean, you've got a backup. And you can probably reinstall all that, but if you can avoid doing it, you're better off. Another thing you can do is convert to Linux. I know very little about Linux, but I have noticed that in the past newsletters, you guys have 7 different articles on this. Maybe there's an 8th coming up. I've looked at the first 2, and I intend to follow along with that and see what I can do about learning Linux. I clicked it again. There we go. Okay, so you can install disk drives in old computers into enclosures for external drives to back up data and to reboot old operating systems. I've done that a lot. I don't like the idea of giving up a computer and having my hard drive in it. I know there's ways around that, refresh and the rest of that, but in the 2 computers that I have that are Windows 10 machines that are going to go belly up, I've got 3 terabytes of drives in those. And I hate the fact that Acer has thrown me under the bus and I'm going to have to give those up. So I'm expecting that those unless somebody is willing to give me a lot of money for those things, which they probably aren't, I'm going to end up with a 1 terabyte and a 2 terabyte external drive and enclosures. I used one of those drives with Windows 7 Pro on it to reboot the Windows 7 machine that I was working on. And that is the only thing that actually got me into that computer. Enclosures are available for large and small drives and SSDs. If you buy an SSD, some manufacturers will give you an enclosure so that you can put the SSD in there, connect it to your computer, bring your files over, and then you can swap it out as your C drive. You can get enclosures for the old, you know, 5-plus-inch machines, for the 3.5-inch drives. They're readily available on the Internet. They're anywhere from 20 to about 60 bucks. These are the two things I stole from Allen. Powering 12-volt devices for LED strips, fans, CB radios. Sorry, it was drink time. You can add USB adapters to charge USB devices like phones, tablets, voice recorders. You can read books if the computer supports the software. Libby, out of Ottawa Public Library, that seems to want pretty up-to-date machines. I can read books on my Google Pixel 7, and it's like reading a newspaper column, but I'm getting used to that. But it doesn't run on a heck of a lot of the older equipment. You can play CDs, DVDs for music, movies from the library. The library has all kinds of stuff that you can do, and you don't need power to do it. You can learn to play chess. You can learn about planetary science. You can learn to crochet. You can learn to knit. You can do virtually anything you want. Now, this is close to the last slide here. I want you to think about layering and confidentiality, and maybe single or multi-purpose uses for a computer. Layering, Chris talks a lot about that, and I think everyone understands it. The whole idea is that between your computer and the Internet, you have several different layers. And the whole idea is that the more layers you have, the more likely an attack is going to be stopped. Now, what better way to layer your computer system than to have a system that never touches the Internet? Now, this is a business model. There are companies out there that are still running Windows XP Pro. They're running it on computer systems that are completely isolated from the Internet. They have a different computer system for things like billing and contracts and communications with clients and that sort of thing. But if anything from that system gets moved over to the internal system, it's cleaned and scanned before it gets in there. So what I'm thinking about is as AI explodes into the World Wide Web, I have no idea what it's going to do in 2 years. But I know that not only the good guys have those tools, but the bad guys have them as well. And I'm sure you know that organized crime has been hiring the best and brightest for years. They pay them gobs of money, maybe 1.5 times what they'd make by doing the same job for another company, and they groom them. They make sure they feel valued, they're part of a family, they're important, they were interviewed and selected on the basis of their character and their knowledge and their skills, and they're just absolutely wonderful. And a lot of those people don't even know they're working for organized crime. If you don't believe me, in private, I'll give you an example of somebody I know who got caught with that. And it took them a year to settle with the police and the Ontario Securities Commission. I don't know if you'd like this idea or not, but store your budget, financial information, investments, wills, and arrange for the passcode to be given to your executor. So instead of giving them a file with 10 tons of paper, you could do it on a computer. Perform small office tasks like word processing, spreadsheets, presentations, creative writing, and poetry. Do you write books? Do you write stories? Do you write articles? Do you write poetry? Why not have a single-use computer for your work on your hobby? There are seniors in Ottawa who will meet you as a family, talk to you about someone you're interested, like someone who served, a relative you have serving in World War I. They will find out everything they can from you about that person. They'll research it, and they'll write you a story, pictures, and they'll do it for free. They'll do it because they're retired, and they love writing, and they like giving back to the community. Okay, storage of archived or research files. If you're a project kind of person, you might want a place where you can focus completely on planetary science or whatever it is that you're doing. I think that's about it. Let me try this again. There it goes. Playing videos for your grandkids. I put this in kind of tongue-in-cheek because you know what kids are like, eh? You know, your grandchildren come over and they see this old computer for these videos. They're probably going to say something. Listen, like, the next time I come, would you mind if I bring my own computer? I'm really into AI and I can do a lot of interesting things with these videos. And you and I can have a blast. So I don't know whether that'll work out too much. So as Woody would say, that's all, folks. As my aunt would say, always have fun. I'm done.
Hey, thank you. Thank you very much, Bill.
You're welcome.
So next up we have, a question came in. This individual's having pop-up messages coming in from while working on email or WhatsApp using the Edge browser to do webmail. But WhatsApp is actually an installed app. So the question was, how do you stop these things? We've had a similar problem previously with Chrome, and one of the suggestions was to basically turn off notifications. So that also can apply to Edge, so that may be a possibility to turn off notifications and block notifications from unwanted sites. And WhatsApp is a bit odd. Apparently, I didn't realize this, but even if you're running the app, it can actually generate pop-ups on a PC, and it can do it even when the app is minimized or closed even. But again, there's some options. You can go to settings and notification and a couple of options to disable notifications when messages are received or when WhatsApp is actually closed and you're trying to make it go away. So those are a couple of suggestions. I don't know if anybody else has got any other things that they've done to stop pop-up ads and in various browsers and applications. If you have, then please put the comments in the chat and we'll get back to those later. Okay, Chris has an answer to a question.
Yeah, this is a question that came into the suggestion box. How does Microsoft Bing compare to Google as a search engine? And I thought, when I first thought, I thought, whoa, that's a pretty, you'll have as many opinions as people that you ask the question from. But I decided that why not ask Perplexity AI? So I asked it to compare the features, advantages, and disadvantages between the search engines Bing and Google Search. And came back with pretty good response. A 569-word response had 22 sources that it pointed to, and they grouped it according to the categories, as you see there, or the paragraphs that you see there. And it was actually kind of neat. So I pasted into the chat where you can get that actual link right to that particular search at Perplexity AI if you want to see all of the nitty-gritty details. And some of the key points that I saw out of it, they said that Google provides more comprehensive suite of specialized search tools when you're not just looking for web content or something like that. Bing focuses more on delivering visually rich experience and fewer specialized searches. It said they do prioritize different factors when ranking content, and I thought that was interesting. They go into a little bit of detail about that. They pointed out that Google has a larger index, hundreds of billions of web pages, whereas Bing has estimated 8 to 14 billion web pages. And it finished up with both search engines continue to evolve, particularly in AI integration, making the competitive landscape dynamic as they strive to provide the most relevant, useful search experience for users. So it was really quite good. And for those that, they're thinking about, well, what about other searches? What do you prefer to use and why. And there are some other major ones out there, Yahoo Search, which is actually powered by Bing, so you're likely to get similar results, I would guess. DuckDuckGo, which emphasizes privacy, doesn't track users. Brave Search, which is private, ad-free. And Ask.com, which has that question and answer sort of format about it. And then you could also go to a meta search engine where it looks up aggregating results from multiple search engines, and there's Dogpile and Metacrawler are two examples of that. So if anybody wants to contribute to the conversation about why they prefer a certain search engine, by all means, we could follow. We're running out of time today, but we could certainly have a follow-up at a future Q&A where people could contribute some information about why they use a particular search engine.
Tom's noting that Bing and Google track you, so you can use DuckDuckGo for more privacy. And then he says, but use Google if the search is unsuccessful.
Yeah. And actually, Perplexity AI, you can actually set it as your default search engine in the web browser, which is kind of neat. And so you can actually, I really like a lot of the stuff you can get from Perplexity when you want to get information from multiple sources and have it all put together in a cohesive sort of summary. It's kind of neat. So I would add Perplexity AI as a search engine of sorts as well.
Yeah, I went one step further. I had it so that the search engine is the address bar. So all I have to do is just type anything in where you would normally put the address bar and go straight to Perplexity.
You can use, there are two control keys. Control L goes to the search bar. Control K goes to the search bar and Control L goes to the URL bar. I use DuckDuckGo and I'm happy with it in 90% of the time. And the rest of the time, I want to do like a special search on images. Or if you go to the advanced Google search, you can do all kinds of fancy stuff to do a search to actually get to what you want.
Lots of people in the chat are suggesting DuckDuckGo is the thing that they use, so that might be worth a look. Okay, another question that came in was how to transfer files between a Windows 10 and a Windows 11 computer, and whether there was a free version of any software that's being used for that. One of the interesting things was that this individual needs to transfer both the applications and the data files because they don't have the original installation media for the applications. So clearly one of the things here is when you're setting up the new computer, make sure you're very proactive in this, and make sure that you keep copies of the software installation disks or files. You also need the activation codes in particular, and that's useful to add into a maintenance log so you always know where they are. And once you've built things, then make a disk image so you can always recover to at least that stage very easily. And Chris and I did that article there, which is worth a look as a reference. The recommended practice seems to be this this item that we had from Ask Leo a while ago. Manually install a fresh copy of Windows and then reinstall the apps from the original media, which is the problem for our questioner, and then restore the data files from your regular backup. Now, if you don't have any installation media, there are some suggestions. These actually come from Perplexity. Apparently, ESUS To-Do has a PC Trans application that's free, but it notes that this has limitations, so I'm not sure what the utility of that is. There's another program called Fast Move, which supposedly moves everything. Or Laplink has a program called PC Mover, which is a paid version. And I think Tom had used that at some point or other quite successfully.
Yeah, it's been around for decades, that Laplink.
Yeah. Anyway, there are some options for that. The final thing I have is a question. If anybody's seen a download error on a recent Windows update. This cumulative update for Windows 10 22H2 5055518 is the keyboard number. And it seems to be a problem. The suggestions were to run the troubleshooter and to run a couple of scanning type, Windows scanning type applications and to fix any corrupted files, etc. I ran that, but Windows Update still won't update these files. So if anybody has any information as to how I get around that, otherwise I'll just keep using Linux for a while and come back to Windows 10 one of these days.
We had a Q&A going way back on how to reset Windows Update. And so there's a short script that stops a couple of services, deletes a couple of directories, and then restarts the services. So you might try that. It should be in the history of Q&A sessions if you search on update. If you can't find it, let me know.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I'll certainly do that. Okay, we are at the witching hour, so we don't have time for more questions this week. We'll go through the chat and see what people said and maybe come back with anything relevant next time. Just want to remind you that if you're a member of the club, we have our one-on-one remote assistance program for issues that don't fit very well into Q&A or questions on the members forum. And the information is available on the web as to how to ask for assistance. Our presentations at OPL, Linda's doing a travel on Alaska. That will be tomorrow.
That one's been canceled.
Okay.
Yeah, they didn't have enough registered for that, so that one is not there. The other ones are still scheduled, though.
Okay, so Rosemount on Thursday the 24th, quick tips for AI tools, and password safe at Centennial on the 25th. Boy, you're busy there, and on end.
Yeah.
Okay, next week we have our special hybrid Q&A. It's going to be at the Emerald Plaza branch of the library, which is Merivale Road. And I had thought that because we were close to Easter, we'd talk about software Easter eggs, and I've mentioned this a few times at Q&A. I still don't have any Easter eggs to share with anybody, so that actually may end up getting dropped. But whatever, we'll still have our regular Q&A session. So if you have questions, if you have answers to some of the things we talked about tonight, if you've got topics that you'd like to share, so thanks to Phil for his information about recycling old or reusing old computers, anything like that, anything computer related, just send us a little note and we'll be happy to put you into the agenda. But for now, that's everything we have. And I thank everybody for attending. Hope you enjoyed it. And we'll see you all next Wednesday on the 23rd.
Thanks for showing up, folks. We'll see you next week.